My name is Cedric Hendricks, and what I want to talk about is the aspect of political struggle that Clarence just touched on. There have been some developments in the federal legislative arena in reaction to the drug problem that I think have sinister consequences for African Americans and the quality of life in our community. We have seen over the past 6 years the Congress enact three major pieces of crime slash anti-drug legislation. There was just a crime bill passed a week ago. There was one passed in 88 and there was one passed in 86. So what you see is on the eve of every national election, those folks up there invest a lot of time and energy in trying to respond in various ways to the crime drug problem. And from my vantage point, the end result of their efforts has been to further encroach upon civil liberties, the drug problem that I think have sinister consequences for African Americans and the quality of life in our community. We have seen over the past 6 years the Congress enact three major pieces of crime slash anti-drug legislation. There was just a crime bill passed a week ago. There was one passed in 88 and there was one passed in 86. So what you see is on the eve of every national election, those folks up there invest a lot of time and energy in trying to respond in various ways to the crime drug problem. And from my vantage point, the end result of their efforts has been to further encroach upon civil liberties. And that is what I want to focus on in particular, and how that impacts negatively on the quality of life in our community and poses an additional and significant threat to us, just as drug addiction itself does. What we have seen in the last 6 years is vociferous advocacy around the expansion of the death penalty. And we have seen that happening in the federal arena. Obviously, you all know that there are 34 or so odd states that have death penalties, and what is happening now is that the federal government has expanded it, the opportunity to be executed at that level. 2 years ago, we saw the expansion of the death penalty to include certain kinds of drug offenses, where if there was a death that resulted in the course of what they described as a major drug transaction, then you could be subjected to the death penalty. Well, this time around, in 1990, they endeavored to take it a step further, and now what they had proposed, and something that I view is clearly unconstitutional, is to execute you for not killing somebody. As I said before, in 88, if a death resulted in the course of a major drug transaction, you could get the death penalty. Now, if you simply sell a major quantity of drugs, they want to be able to execute you. Now, obviously, under past Supreme Court precedent, that kind of practice would be unconstitutional. And obviously, you have a Congress full of people who profess to be, in many respects, sensitive to or aware of or informed about the requirements of the Constitution. But notwithstanding that, there are a whole bunch of them that are out here aggressively lobbying for the enactment of this legislation, notwithstanding the obvious constitutional problems attendant to it. That almost passed, and I'll come back to why some of these things I'm talking about didn't make the cut this time, but almost did. Another thing that is relevant with respect to the death penalty is that there were some progressive members of Congress who, in an effort to try and mitigate the impact of what these fools are doing in promoting the death penalty, have attempted to sustain or gain the enactment of the Racial Justice Act. And the Racial Justice Act is a piece of legislation that would essentially block the imposition of the death penalty where a defendant could show that the jurisdiction, be it state or federal, that was seeking to impose it had demonstrated a pattern of imposing it in a racially discriminatory manner. So that if a defendant could, through the use of statistical evidence, show that there was a pattern of disparity in how this death penalty was being administered, that would essentially stop the case and return it to the court where there would be some additional examination of the sentence that was imposed. There's been great resistance to this because those prosecutors around the country who are very anxious to execute people, those U.S. attorneys, because what we're talking about is expansion at the federal level, they argued that this would act as a total block, that once statistics were presented that would show this disparity, that they would be unable to overcome them. Well, there was a great battle around this in the Congress this year, and we were able to get the Racial Justice Act attached to the death penalty bills that passed the House. We weren't able to get it attached to the bill in the Senate, but ultimately when the bills went into the conference process, we were able to sustain the attachment or the linkage between the expansion of the death penalty and the inclusion of the Racial Justice Act. So the point is, if they're going to execute more people, they're going to have to do it in a manner that's not racially discriminatory. It's our hope that that will obviously continue to thwart the imposition of the death penalty. Now, some of the other things, and let me just mention two others, so I can be brief. One has to do with the exclusionary rule. Obviously, you've heard about the Fourth Amendment limitation on search and seizure. And the exclusionary rule is something that has developed in jurisprudence whereby searches that are conducted in a manner inconsistent with the Fourth Amendment protections are tainted, and so the fruits of those searches can't be used to the detriment of the defendant. Well, recently the Supreme Court issued a case that created the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, where if a court had issued a warrant and the police acted on a warrant, and even though the warrant was subsequently shown to be invalid, if the police acted in good faith reliance upon it when they kicked your door down and came in and did whatever they wanted to do and found contraband that ultimately was used to convict you, well, the Supreme Court said, well, that's okay, because the police acted in good faith even though the paper that they were operating on was flawed. Well, the people in Congress want to further expand on that and give the police the power to act without a warrant, so that if Mr. or Ms. Police Officer has a good faith belief that there's some contraband in your house without the necessity of having to go down and find a judge to issue a flawed warrant, they can just kick your door in and go into court and profess that, well, you know, I mean, I know this brother and I've seen him selling crack up on the corner for the last 6 months, so I just know that he's got some stash in his house, so, you know, I had a reasonable good faith belief that I'd find something in there, so I just kicked his door in. Well, that's where they're headed. That was something that fortunately we were able to keep out of the bill this time, but it's an idea that these people have been pushing forward for the last 4 years that will surface again. Last thing I want to talk about is habeas corpus, and what that is a process whereby defendants can challenge convictions based upon constitutional considerations. That notwithstanding the fact that you were convicted of some kind of crime, if you can argue effectively that your constitutional rights were violated in one of many kind of ways, that you didn't have effective assistance of counsel, that there was bias, for instance, in the jury selection process, that in some way, shape, or form your constitutional rights were infringed on, well, you have available to you the habeas corpus route of attacking your conviction that you can apply both at the state level and the federal level. Well, that is something that has been particularly useful for those brothers and sisters or third world people who've been the target of capital convictions. And so you hear the conservatives across the country talking about it seems to take forever to execute some folk. There have been people on death row for 14, 15 years, and we still can't get rid of them, and that's just unconscionable when you get all these poor victims and their families out here who, you know, been waiting for justice for so long, but yet these cases just drag on and on. Well, the conservatives want to, of course, expedite the execution process, notwithstanding the fact that research done by recognized folk in the field of law suggests that when you look at the kinds of appeals that have been raised with respect to death sentences, that you find 70% of those constitutional challenges ultimately leading to some kind of reversal at the appellate level. And so, you know, the point is that those people who continue to fight these death convictions over that long period of time more often than not wind up finding some or establishing some kind of constitutional flaw which triggers a reversal and sending the case back down for some further adjudication. Well, you know, these folk don't want to see that happen anymore. They're clearly determined to eliminate that right and execute, obviously, innocent people, people whose rights may well have been violated. They just don't want you to have the time and the opportunity to prove it. And so what they had tried to put in place was a requirement that you had to bring all of your habeas corpus issues forward within 1 year after your conviction. Now, the problem with that is because very often people who are confronted with capital cases don't have effective assistance of counsel. That has been the basis for that 70% of, you know, for the large part of 70% of the cases have been overturned on appeal. There was a survey by the National Law Journal that I read about, which talked about how, you know, like half of the folk who are involved in capital cases have attorneys who've never been involved in a capital case before. And obviously these are cases which involve some special knowledge and expertise, because they're complicated this way. The Supreme Court has mandated that there's essentially a two-step process. One involves dealing with the question of guilt or innocence, and if you're convicted or you plead guilty, then there's a second process whereby they determine whether or not the death penalty can be imposed, and that process requires the review of what they call aggravating and mitigating circumstances, and they have to go and prove that there were aggravating factors that are manifest in your case that justify the imposition of a death sentence. And then the defendant, of course, will try and show that there were some mitigating factors, like they were under the age of 18 when the crime was committed, or they were the least culpable of a group of people who were connected with killing somebody, or something like that. Well, needless to say, the conservatives want to minimize the opportunity for us to be able to put forward those kinds of mitigating factors. They want to streamline the process. And so, fortunately, and as I wrap up, let me say that what happened, one of the positive things that came as a result of all the confusion in the Congress around this whole budget battle was that they began to give up fighting for some of the things that they wanted simply to close off the process and be able to go home. So when the crime bill was in the conference committee and those who wanted the death penalty were arguing over that, for that, and those, you know, in the minority, but nonetheless mounting some significant opposition, arguing against it, were putting forward their fight. Those who were into this whole gun thing, because there were some provisions in the bill that would impact or restrict the manufacture of assault weapons in this country, and of course the NRA was trying to keep the opportunity available for all of us to own an M16. They pulled all of that stuff out of the bill and basically passed a crime bill that just had money in it for law enforcement assistance. So in short, all the ugly stuff came out, not necessarily as a result of progressives being able to effectively manipulate or impact the legislative process, just because the bad guys decided to fold their tent and come back next year. There's formidable opposition out there, opposition to the progressive viewpoint. We don't necessarily have the votes to prevail. What we have to do, obviously, is to continue to struggle in the political arena, throw out some of these deadbeats who are putting forward these kinds of the manufacture of assault weapons in this country, and of course the NRA was trying to keep the opportunity available for all of us to own an M16. They pulled all of that stuff out of the bill and basically passed a crime bill that just had money in it for law enforcement assistance. So in short, all the ugly stuff came out, not necessarily as a result of progressives being able to effectively manipulate or impact the legislative process, just because the bad guys decided to fold their tent and come back next year. There's formidable opposition out there, opposition to the progressive viewpoint. We don't necessarily have the votes to prevail. What we have to do, obviously, is to continue to struggle in the political arena, throw out some of these deadbeats who are putting forward these kinds of heinous ideas, and elect candidates that are progressive in nature that are going to fight against this kind of stuff. With that, I'll stop and listen to the next panel.